Hey, before we start, we're excited to announce that we have a new sponsor. Coffee with the Greats is brought to you by Bixby Coffee. So for season two, we're bringing you the complete package. We've already been bringing you the greats. Now Bixby will bring you the coffee. Hey, this is Miles. You're listening to Coffee with the Greats. This is the podcast where my father and I talk with living legends about their life's journey and what they learned along the way. If you've been enjoying the show, please leave a rating. Apparently, 5-star reviews make a big difference in how likely this will get recommended to the kind of listener who's going to like it. And they're probably going to like today's episode because it's with one of the coolest guys I've ever met. Bob Pittman is a lot of things. Currently, he's the CEO of iHeartMedia, America's number one audio platform that reaches 9 out of 10 Americans every month. That's a larger reach than Facebook. But Bob's been behind the biggest megaphones in the world for the last 40 years. He's the son of a Methodist preacher in Jackson, Mississippi, and he got a high school side job as a radio DJ before quickly shooting up the charts to host the country's biggest radio station out of New York. He then got plucked to help create MTV and serve as its first CEO. I mean, what a time that must have been. He then became CEO of companies like AOL, Six Flags, Century 21 Real Estate, Time Warner Enterprises, Clear Channel. You know, you talk to some of these incredible guests we're lucky to speak with, and you do your best to prepare and research and try to ask some thoughtful questions. But with guys like Jamie Dimon and Mike Milken, there's only so much I can add, especially when my dad is much more fluent in the financial world. But Bob Pittman's brain works the way mine does. He's a creative entrepreneur. He observes people's behavior, and then he communicates to them in their own language. He's really a marketer at heart. I met Bob in the middle of a desert at this thing called Burning Man many years ago. I didn't know anything about him professionally, but his camp was the coolest spot on the playa, and he was just the most captivating conversationalist I'd met. You know when you meet someone who's equally a really great talker and also a great listener? That's Bob. He's in my friend group, he's what you'd just call a really great hang. He's also absolutely brilliant. So sit back, brew up a cup, and enjoy another great episode of Coffee with the Greats with Bob Pittman.
Well, I was born in Jackson, Mississippi. My parents, my mother was a school teacher. My dad was a Methodist minister. And early in life, he had his own church. And later in life, he was in the executive branch of the church. So he's what's called a district superintendent in the Methodist church. He was over a group of churches and moved ministers in and out. But was a very interesting life because it kept us moving a lot. Because Methodist ministers, the Methodists were a Bible study group originally in the Anglican Church, Episcopalian Church, and they were circuit riders, and they would go from town to town to town. So the Methodist Church sort of had that as their philosophy, as circuit riders. So they never want you to stay too long in a community. A little weird. I don't think they do it anymore, but it put me in about 5 towns growing up.
Always in Mississippi in the state?
Always in Mississippi, always in South Mississippi.
And how did how'd you not develop a Southern accent?
Oh, I had a very deep and rich Southern accent, but I got a job as a disc jockey on the radio at age 15. And to be on the radio, you had to work hard not to sound like this and talk the way everybody else does. So I trained myself not to talk like that. Of course, if you're in New York, you still hear my accent as a heavy Southern accent, but to Southerners, they don't hear it that way.
And you go back to Mississippi, do you readopt it?
If I'm around Southerners or I get tired or have a little bit to drink, the Southern accent comes roaring back.
But you first
you know, started working as a DJ really just to make a little scratch on the side because your passion was planes, as I understand.
Absolutely.
You grew up loving flying.
I loved airplanes. The irony was my grandfather ran a lumber mill for a very wealthy family in southern Mississippi, and they had a corporate airplane. And my grandfather's nephew was the corporate pilot, went on to fly for Delta Airlines. And actually, my grandfather could use the corporate plane, but would never get in an airplane. But when I go visit him in Picayune, Mississippi, he would take me to the airport to entertain me and just let me crawl all over the airplanes and look at airplanes and watch them take off and land. And so I got completely hooked on airplanes. And you can solo it 16. So I tell my parents at 15, I want to get my pilot's license. And they said, well, you better find a job. And I tried to get a job at the Hip Place, which was a men's clothing store where all the kids hung out after school, Jack Shop. They said I was too young. I tried to get the high paying job in town, which was bagging groceries at the Piggly Wiggly. And they had none. And I walked in a radio station and a fellow named Bill Jones owned this little daytime only radio station. And he said, Do you have good grades? And I go, yeah, pretty good. Said, do you get in trouble? I go, not really. And he goes, well, come in here. He put me in a room with a tape recorder and a microphone, ripped off some, in those days, he had teletype machines, ripped off the news, said, read this. I read it. He listened to it. And he goes, that's good enough. Go to New Orleans, get your third class radio telephone operator's license, which means I could run the transmitter. And you got a job. And that began my radio career. I did learn to fly. I have an airline transport pilot's license. And my grandfather never, ever flew with me. Never gotten an airplane, but probably was responsible for getting me interested in planes.
So what were you flying back in those days when you first started?
I soloed in a Cessna 150 before the days of a 152, which had a little more power, two-seater Cessna. And I flew Cessna 172s. And as the more money I got, the little better the airplane. So that was always my marker as I went along. And at about age 30, I learned to fly helicopters, so I added that to it as well. So fly airplanes and helicopters. But I'm getting to the point now where I'm saying, you know, I'm 67. Should I really be sitting in that left seat in the Falcon 900? I don't know when that age is. I've given up motorcycles. I got rid of motorcycles a couple of years ago and said my reflexes are not what they once were. So I know one day I'll give up flying, but not yet.
There's still a future for Zeppelins. I really feel like air blimps coming back.
I don't know, but you know, I've never been in a Zeppelin. One of the few things I've not been in, but they look pretty cool, but they look like they do lumber a bit and don't go very fast.
And so, Bob, you're 15 years old. It's 1968. You are the son of a preacher, but you're alive and happy to have a job. What did school look like? I mean, this is kind of the beginning, particularly in Mississippi, of social integration. Segregation's a big issue. What did your day look like when you were 15 years old?
Well, you know, I think you've hit on it. In the South and the 60s, the whole issue was desegregating the South. And when I started school, they had black schools and white schools. They had colored only bathrooms and rooms. And when I graduated from high school, my school was 50-50 white black. So everything happened in that period of time. And my dad was going through sort of a parallel journey. The Methodist Church in Mississippi that was organized in conferences, and they had two conferences in the same geographic area. One was black, one was white. So my dad became the leader to integrate the two. And it had to be voted on by the lay people, which were the congregations, not the clergy. And I remember as a kid, and I was a young kid then, he had a little red book, and it was Robert's Rules of Order. It was in the bathroom, it was in the bedroom. He kept reading it. And he, I think, correctly ascertained at that moment in time, he didn't think the lay people would just vote this right in. So he got people sort of procedurally not quite sure what was going on. And when they had the vote and they said, everybody for it, stand up, my dad sat down. And it turns out they were all looking to my dad as the as the barometer of this thing, because I know my dad wanted to integrate the church, and my dad voted against his own proposal, and it passed, only because I think he had spent the time and effort on Robert's Rules of Order. So, and then my dad in the executive branch spent a lot of his career trying to mentor some of the black ministers, push them to churches that have been predominantly white congregations. And on the school side, it was a process where they first had freedom of choice. So you'd have two or three white kids at a predominantly black school, and you'd have two or three black kids at a predominantly white school. And then when they said, okay, enough of that, let's really integrate the schools. It was an interesting blow to the South, because you found out what people really were committed to. Some towns said, we're not going to start private academies that are white only. We're going to work, and we're going to keep this public school together. And others did start, you know, predominantly white academies. I'm not sure any of them were all white. And what's interesting today is the school systems that are doing well and the best in Mississippi are the ones where they kept all the kids in the same school. And I think was a real testament to people pulling together, on all the communities to try and build a future for the South and for the community.
So you, in the 60s, of course, we went through incredible turmoil. Bobby Kennedy's assassination, first Jack Kennedy, then Bobby Kennedy, and of course, Martin Luther King. Did that have any impact on you as a young man?
It did. It was interesting. I'm going to go back to my dad, who I'm a great admirer of. When President Kennedy was assassinated, we were in a little town in Mississippi, and my dad said, I want to go do a prayer for him on the radio. And the owner of the radio station said, yes, we want you to do that, but don't use your name, because there are too many people who don't like John Kennedy. So my dad had to anonymous minister offer a prayer, which tells you how crazy it was back then. And for me, it certainly had an impact, because my family was, you know, had a particular bent, which I believe was the morally courageous position to be in, even though it may not at that moment have been popular. So it had a big impact, because you felt like, oh my God, we're losing this battle when those things happen, and you remember them too. It was tough times, and it was a great time. I couldn't wait to get out of Mississippi. I was sort of embarrassed, and I thought I was escaping something. My brother stayed with an idea that he wanted to work and make the state a better place and contribute to the state, and really committed his life to doing that, which I'm a great admirer of. And I think looking back, I probably took the easy way out.
With your father being someone who community came to just for spiritual guidance, to answer the big questions: who am I? Why am I here? How do I find purpose? How did your dad kind of compartmentalize doing that professionally as a calling to the public, his congregation, but then also just through leadership for you and your brother, and you know, his teammate, your mom?
Yeah, it is. I only appreciate that I had a very weird life after the fact. And when my dad died, my brother, you know, we've sort of reminisced about how unusual we were. But I actually never saw my mother or father say a crossword to each other in the whole time they were alive. I can't do that. I'm certainly never, but I didn't understand how unusual that was. So I grew up in a household where there wasn't fighting. There was a lot of talking, and there was a lot of empathy, and there was a lot of concern for others. So I think my dad and my mom, because I think they really did it together and were in that together, that their life was not compartmentalized. It was just, this was the life they were leading, and they it both enjoyed and felt the obligation and a need and their life purpose to help other people. And my mother was one of those mothers that, you know, I could bring home a near criminal kid home with me, and instead of saying, don't hang out with that kid, she'd say, you know, I don't think anybody's paying attention to that little boy, so why don't you bring him over here? So it was that kind of household I grew up in, which you know had a huge impact on me and my brother.
How old were you when they passed away? Or how long
ago? It was my dad passed away only a few years ago. My mom passed away in 2003. So I was a grown man and an adult. And I was supposed to be the daughter that my mother always wanted. Fortunately, she lived long enough to see me. My brother had two sons, and I had two sons, and then the next one was a girl. So she lived long enough to see a girl, and we named her after her mother. So that was nice.
Wonderful. And I'm skipping ahead a little bit here, but what'd your mom and what'd your dad think about MTV?
Well, hold on, because we're skipping a lot. I mean, let's just go to the age of 23, because there's a big, you know, now Bob's behind the mic, the biggest microphone in America, WNBC, and you're still a young man. Talk about your early 20s and just the media landscape, because that was major.
I sort of had to get there, and I you know, started radio because I love flying and it was a job, and then the radio bug bit me, and I went to Jackson, Mississippi. I worked on the 102.9 stereo rock in Jackson, which was this big underground FM that went all the way from Memphis to New Orleans. So when I showed up at college my freshman year, people actually knew who I was, which sort of surprised me, because in a little town, everybody knows everybody. It's no big deal. You're on the radio. And I worked on a couple of stations in Jackson. Then I got a job with the big time in Milwaukee, and after my freshman year in college, and I was going to go work summer relief and then come back in the fall for school. And when I got up there, some got left to go to Chicago, and I got a full-time job. So I never came home. So I went through Milwaukee, Detroit, Pittsburgh, and I began programming radio stations, programmed my first station in Pittsburgh. I was 19 years old and I had a big win. And my boss's boss actually got fired and went to NBC in Chicago and called me up and said, "You want to come here?" And I go, I was 20. I go, "Yeah." And I'm going to go program a station. And he said, "Oh, by the way, we're going to make the station country." And I go, "I don't know anything about country music." He said, "You'll figure it out." So I went. We had a big win with that one, biggest country station in America. And then they gave me the FM and had a big win there doing album rock. And then they sent me at age 23 and my boss, who had brought me there to New York to fix WNBC in New York. And so that's how I got there. And New York was, that was Studio 54. It was Saturday Night Fever. It was Death Wish, Scary Town. Everything was happening. Everything was a little dirty, a little seedy. The city almost went bankrupt. And for a kid from Mississippi, it was a pretty interesting place. When I got to towns, you know how people sort of tell you, okay, look, put their arm around you, and go, okay, let me tell you how to handle the city. And they say, okay, if you're walking along the street and you see somebody on the sidewalk, you don't know, walk out in the street and walk in the middle of the street. Don't walk on the sidewalk past them. If somebody looks like they're a little dangerous, walk in and go into the doorman building. And they said, if somebody looks like they're looking at you funny and you're worried about, put your hand in your jacket like you've got a gun. They don't know whether you do or not. They'll move on to the next person. Why take the chance on you? This is the kind of advice I'm getting. So you can imagine this one. Wow, I've arrived in the big city. And you know, then you go to places like Studio 54, which I had never seen anything like that in my life. Was an eye opener. And out of that sort of craziness came an enormous amount of creativity. And there were a lot of people like me who are from little towns around the country who came to the big city. And that was the big city, and everybody had new ideas and people were exchanging them. And this was the birth of, at that time, high tech was cable TV. This was the birth of cable TV. We were the Googles, we were the Facebooks of this time. And I left WNBC to go to Warner Amex Satellite Entertainment Corporation as their programming guy at age 25.
And in so doing, you made a mentor with one of the extraordinary figures in media of the last 100 years, Steve Ross.
I did. Steve Ross was an amazing guy. I show up at the company and I have a meeting or two with Steve, and Steve takes a liking to me. And Steve was one of these wonderful guys that he really didn't care what your job was. He's wanted you in the discussion, and Steve was almost 100% about brainstorming. It was always new ideas moving forward. And it's from Steve, I have this idea. When we talk about work, I go, you know, most of what we do every day is just keeping us from falling apart and just keeping it moving. But the only way you grow a business is from insights and epiphanies. You got to have a great idea. There's got to be something. I got it. I know what we can do. But it's that. And Steve knew that intuitively. And his company was always about that. And Steve's the first one to tell me, and I now repeat it to everyone because it's my mantra too. He said, in this company, you will never be fired for making a mistake. In this company, you'll be fired for not making a mistake. Because if you're not making mistakes, tells me you're not trying anything new. And if you're not trying anything new, the assets we've given you to manage will wither away under stewardship. So he was looking for mistakes as the byproduct of innovation, as the evidence that you were innovating. And that was a company into which we just tried stuff all the time. Now, some of it worked. Some of it worked for a while. Some of it never worked. We went way up with Atari Games at Warner Communications. And then when Atari Games fell, it almost took the company under. Mike Milken saved the company. It was there with capital at the right moment. But it was a great experience. And for me, Steve sort of set, I guess, for me, because I was young and impressionable, set for me how you manage for innovation.
This is pretty meteoric. You go from Jackson and Hattiesburg to suddenly you're in the big time. You're sitting in front of Steve Ross. Were there moments where you felt uncomfortable, or what did you draw upon?
You know, I felt very limited. I never finished college. I didn't know any fancy people. The fanciest person I ever knew was the guy who owned the sawmill where my grandfather was the general manager. But I did know I would work hard. I was blessed with a pretty good brain. It was interesting. It was an interesting time because I saw myself in sort of limited potential. And there's a fellow named Spencer Harrison who had been Bill Paley's lieutenant, head of business affairs at CBS. He got passed over to be president. He left and joined a fellow named Ted Ashley. They had an agency, Ashley Famous, that managed Lucille Ball. And they eventually sold their agency to Steve Ross. It was Steve Ross's first foray into entertainment. He had been in building services and funeral homes,
and car rentals,
office cleaning, the whole bit, and it all sort of built from his father-in-law's two funeral homes, and Spencer was this sort of remarkable guy, and at about this time in my career, Steve was sort of sending me off to do stuff that wasn't my job, but just like, oh yeah, go work on this some. And Spencer sort of took me as his lieutenant, so it took me under his wing. And I still remember the day we were getting on the company plane. I couldn't believe I was doing all this. And Spencer said, you know, Bob, one day you could run this company. And I had never thought of that even as a possibility. I never even dreamed of it. Never even crossed my mind that I could run the company, that I had that kind of potential. I mean, I was thinking, man, I'm going to be the head of programming. We're going to have a successful network. But I have very limited aspirations. And Spencer's the guy to open my eyes to, you know, it's what somebody got you don't have. Don't be intimidated. And it was sort of from that moment on, I sort of saw the world a little differently. And my parents had been, when I was building this radio career, I was in Milwaukee, Detroit, Pittsburgh, and then finally I show up in Chicago at NBC. And all through this, I was going to college at the same time. And my parents said, and my parents didn't have much money, but they were very well educated. My dad had his master's from Emory in Atlanta. My mother was a college graduate, which was very unusual in Mississippi at that time to have anybody with a graduate degree and both parents with college degrees. And they kept saying, why don't you just quit this radio thing and just go to college? My dad says, the only time in your life you're going to have no responsibilities. You can just think and you can develop who you want to be. This radio thing, he says, this is going nowhere. Don't do that. And probably, I was probably 30 at the time. And my parents said, you know, I sure am glad you didn't listen to us. So that was, you know, the answer to what they thought about MTV. And, you know, they understood what radio was. They didn't quite understand what cable TV was, much less MTV, but they were proud of it.
Coffee with the Greats is brought to you by a truly great coffee. Bixby Coffee. Bixby Coffee is roasted and shipped the same day you order it for the freshest, most convenient coffee you can find. Now, I genuinely believe Bixby is the perfect coffee to brew at home because I founded the company. And over the years, we've worked very hard to perfect the home coffee experience. I've been a coffee guy my whole life, and I've learned that no matter how you make your coffee, you always want the freshest roasted beans possible. So any coffee that's sitting on a grocery store shelf is inevitably going to be more stale than coffee that's been roasted and shipped directly to you the same day. Not only is our coffee insanely fresh, but it's made of the highest quality, sustainably sourced beans from around the world. Go to BixbyCoffee.com to discover the finest coffee blends and single origins. We offer whole bean, fresh ground, Keurig pods, and even specialty instant coffee. And if you live in the US, shipping is always free. Use code GREATS for 30% off your first order. That comes to less than 10 bucks to have the freshest coffee you've ever made delivered right to your home. This is the good stuff, I promise. That's BixbyCoffee.com, B-I-X-B-Y coffee.com. Back to the conversation.
One of the exciting things about this little podcast project is we have an audience of young people who follow me and kind of more established people who follow my dad. But Steve Ross kind of being the last true mogul in the all-encompassing sense, record labels and movie studios, sports teams, the New York Cosmos, all of this. But he also, it seems like he had an extraordinary talent of just collecting and surrounding himself by young people. I mean, you were kind of the young inner circle with guys named Quincy Jones and Steven Spielberg. And then, of course, you have Milkins. Is that something that you also just adopted, the ability to stay young through constantly surrounding yourself by people who are not encumbered by previous experience, that they're kind of blank tablet brain?
You know, I think it starts with you want a collaborative environment. Some people don't want a collaborative environment. Steve did, I do, and I think you're exactly right. So if you have a collaborative environment, you need energy, juice, and you need fresh views. At MTV, because we were young, we quite arrogantly used to say, no one over the age of 30 has any good ideas. All the great ideas come from young people. There's probably some truth to that. I mean, I think the sort of sheer raw creativity comes in your 20s. You begin to put framework around it, experience to it, et cetera, later. But, you know, you need a good dose of that. You always need that push. And I've always tried to find just, you know, interesting, brilliant, innovative people and surround myself with them. And it's, and I've taken, you know, with young people, part of my job is to help them shape a good idea, as someone helped me shape a good idea when I was young. And I think putting all kinds of diverse voices in the mix is very important. I've long been a believer in diversity, not for any, you know, oh, I'm worried about, you know, I've got some law I've got to abide by, but because you need diverse voices to get diverse ideas. And I think people outside the system often have the freshest ideas. So, I mean, when I was at MTV, we had a pretty remarkable diversity slate of managers and producers and talent. And I think that was critical to the success of MTV. And I've found it's always been critical to every success I've had. And I also put in diversity in and out of the system. I love people who grew up in Nowheresville, USA, and they come to New York and they have a fresh perspective. And they go, no, that's not what's going on. They intuitively know middle America. And I think part of the problem in the media business is it really resides on the coast. And it's very easy to forget that that's not the majority of people in this country. You know, if you were in New York City, people were shocked that Donald Trump won. If you knew about middle America, you would know that there was a great group of people who felt they'd been disenfranchised by people on the coast, forgotten about, not recognized. And they were looking for a way to send a very important message.
This is music to my Texas ears, by the way.
Mississippi ears.
People in the state, 11 million more than New York, and yet the media is so dominated by the East and West Coast. You're right.
Right.
And I'm wondering if you learned a little bit about that with your country western experience in Chicago. That was the biggest broadcasting station.
Yeah. You know, it was, but I think probably with our top 40 stations too, and right. Everything I've done, I've been a very heavy user of research. I had this experience when I was in college my freshman year. I was on a top 40 station. They let me be the music director and they let me pick the music. And I picked all the music my friends liked in the dorm. And the ratings, I think, dropped in half. And that was the last time I listened to my point of view and said, I better get something better than that. And over time, I was in radio just as consumer research was beginning to be used to help figure out how to program a radio station. And I had some big wins, and I was winning big because I just took myself out of the equation and said, okay, let's go look at people and what do they like? What don't they like? What are they responding to? What aren't they? We ran a radio station. We just say plays less commercials. And people go, well, that's not grammatically correct. It's fewer commercials. And I go, no one says fewer commercials. They say less commercials. So it's a matter of using the vernacular of people as well. I was watching a particular debate. You won't have to use your imagination to figure out which one, a few years ago. And somebody was talking about incarceration and somebody else is talking about putting them in jail. One connects, one disconnects. And I think, you know, when you're talking about especially a mass product, the language you use is code. And code is more important than the explicit language you use. So I've, as a marketer, always tried to understand that and not pass a value judgment, but just say it is. And my goal is to communicate. My goal is not to have someone accept my point of view. And I think, you know, if you can detach yourself like that when you're doing it, running consumers products or services company, it becomes critically important. I mean, you know, you look at the telco wars going on now, you know, it's all about sort of winning that hearts and minds. 5G is coming. Going to be one of the biggest battles, I think, that we've seen in media in quite some time, because it's going far beyond telcos. It's going to influence everything. Maybe it's an exaggeration. It's going to be as important as the internet. But I think that, you know, how does the average person relate to it versus how do the people who know about it relate to it? And I think those are the critical moments in marketing and advertising. And I think at the end of the day, I'm probably, no matter what my title is, probably a marketer. And it's all about connecting with those consumers.
But you have to base it on analytics, is what you're saying.
Someone told me once, and I think it's true, is research is not policymaking. Every decision you make will be a gut decision. The question is your gut conditioned by your next door neighbor, or is it conditioned by having just looked at a study you did of the entire country broken out by every possible segment? You're still, and there was a great friend of mine, Marshall Cohen, who was the research director. Actually, he was worked for the outside firm that did the original concept test for MTV. And we used that to convince the board that there was a demand for this thing. And then we brought Marshall aboard as our research director, and he ran some other management jobs, marketing and running the movie channel and some other services. But it was interesting that Marshall and I have been together. He was at AOL with me. He's done some stuff at iHeart with me. He did stuff at Six Flags with me. I don't think we've ever agreed. And we know each other very well. We look at exactly the same data, and he says, saying this. I go, no, it's saying this. And then we have that scrappy fight over what it could mean. So, 90% of it is, you have to have the data, but 90% of it is the interpretation. And I'm sort of amused today at everybody talking about their data, as if their data is doing anything more than just providing some information that they have to use to make a decision. But they're hiding behind the data. So data says nothing. The data is giving you some insights, but it's up to you to figure out what it means.
I wish I was looking at the Open Market Committee at the Federal Reserve. a minor role, but still, data is old by the time you get it.
Yeah.
You figure out how to interpret it and use it.
it also can tell you, you know, you can, I can look at the same data and say it's saying this, and somebody else can look at exactly the same piece and say, no, I think what it's doing is telling us this. And so you got to go, you're right. It could be both. Which one is it? Where do we want to bet? And sometimes you wind up doing A-B tests. We'll do a little bit of this, a little bit of that, and let's figure it out in the real world. And sometimes you just have to jump in. And I think, you know, as a business person, and you've been there before, both of you, is the worst thing you can do is not make a decision. I just think, you know, it is, if I sort of live by a philosophy, it's make quick decisions. You're invariably going to be wrong. I think probably if you can get decisions right 50% of the time, you're a genius. So if you can understand that you're not going to get it right by just thinking it through, then just move quickly. And if you do the wrong thing, then change it quickly. And you'll change it so fast that you'll find the right answer, but you're not going to find it through waiting, fretting, studying, talking. And I think it's one of the major mistakes people make. It's a, again, it goes back to Steve Ross's, part of our corporate values at iHeart is we expect and tolerate mistakes. It's part of innovation. It's a byproduct of innovation. And if you look at it any other way, you're going to find people not moving because they're a fear of making a mistake. And the mistake's not to be feared. It's just, it's a learning experience. And I tell my kids who get upset about making mistakes, I go, you know, there's no difference between a mistake and a success. They're both stepping stones. The only difference is when you step on a success, you keep going in the same direction. When you step on a failure, you change your direction. But there, you're not, you haven't arrived. There is no success where you've arrived or any failure where you've ended. It's just a step in the journey.
I hear an entrepreneur giving that advice because I'm, as you're saying this, I'm pumping my fist in the air. You know, people will ask me, how do I, younger people who are just kind of emerging out of college, you know, how do I focus on the right idea? And I just think that the value is in implementation. Keep on implementing on your ideas and the right idea will choose you. Just make it happen. And I find so much, I've always viewed myself, you know, I know you've referred to yourself, Bob, almost as a sociologist. You know, you study the consumer. I know you like books like Incognito, The Secret Life of the Brain. And to me, it's both sides of the brain. It's kind of EQ and IQ. And I look at data and I look at numbers. But the truth is, when you're a DJ and you're in charge of getting the party going and getting everybody synced on the same energy, it's your gut. And let's drop the needle and let's start. And you just see it in real time. It's this kind of fifth, sixth sense.
You know, it's funny. I have a podcast called Math and Magic. Yeah. Stories from the Frontiers of Marketing. And I named it that because I've always talked about marketing and programming as being math and magic. That to be great in marketing, I have to have the data part. I've got to know what it is. I've got to find it. But then I got to do something with it. I mean, I'm always sort of amused by people who go, yeah, I was on Google and we found it and we got this. We found all those people. I go, great. Now, what are you going to do now that you found them? How are you gonna excite them? Are you gonna put a little line of script there, and that's gonna have them go, wow, I gotta have that product? I said, you need the magic. And as you point out with the DJs, they're pure magic. It is like, I gotta get you excited. So for me in marketing, it's always, and in programming, it's always, I need to know what's really going on, where those people are, how they're behaving, and then I gotta excite them. And that's the showmanship. And what am I gonna do to get it? And I think it's a mistake so many big companies make, is they spend all their time on data, and then their creativity is so lame because they're afraid of great creativity, and they want to do it by committee. I've never seen great magic come from committee. Great magic comes from people who've got it, and you go, yes, let's support that person. And when I've run marketing campaigns and been a client of agencies, I always tell them, give me two or three creative teams. Don't have them talk to each other, and don't filter any of their work, and then have them come back and talk to me. And I'm going to pick one of those for the magic. But you don't, you know, you can work methodically as a mathematician through the math side of it. There is no process through the creative side. I find what you do in most of the studies about it are that you load your head up with the issue and then you forget about it. And at the time, you're the most relaxed. You're almost in the alpha state. You're in that sort of transcendental zone. You're sort of half awake, half asleep. Mine happens to be, I take about a 15-minute hot shower every day and just go into a zone. Every idea flows out at that moment. And it's not, oh, and then this and this. It's like, I got it. It's the eureka moments. And that's the way magic comes. And I think when you go into too many people in too big an organization, say, I got it, unless you're the boss, by the time you got it, it's turned into some watered down committee decision, and it's not very good anymore. And so I think it is part of my job as a leader, too, is to empower the people who've got the magic to go do it and keep everybody off of them. Don't let the junkyard dogs attack them. Give them a free run with it, and let's get that idea done. Let's give it a try. It's betting. You're betting on people and betting on their ideas.
It's so hard in a large organization to keep that entrepreneurial spirit.
And you know, it's you're exactly right. I think part of it is that I think a lot of CEOs they get confused about what delegation means. And what they're really doing is they're avoiding, they say, well, somebody else should make that decision. Why? Sometimes they can't agree. You've got to step in and make one. And I think they're very afraid of that. And I've got friends who are. And sometimes I am. But I think the challenge we have is that, it's got to make a decision. Also, people want to put off things. They want to slow down. And one of my favorite techniques is asking everybody in the room, what are we going to know tomorrow we don't know right now? If the answer is nothing, then let's just make the decision now. Then all we're doing by waiting till tomorrow is we're procrastinating on a hard decision as opposed to getting any better with the decision. And by the way, if we let it linger too long, we're going to rationalize ourselves right into a corner. So let's just make the decision and get on with it. Do it.
In keeping with the spirit of what Miles and I are doing here with the father-son format, I'm curious as to what else you're imparting to your children. And what should be their guiding principles in addition to what we just expressed or what you just expressed?
Boy, that's a great question. And I wish I could say I'm the perfect father and I'm proud of everything I've done fathering. I think the older I get, the more questions I have about whether I did a good job as a parent. I think it's probably the hardest thing you do in life. I think the most important thing I'm trying to get my kids, because I grew up without much money and I grew up without anything other than a very loving family and a roof over my head and people who appreciated education and knowledge and ideas. And my kids grew up, I think, in a tougher world because they did have some privilege and they do have a lot of opportunities. But what I try and push them to is define yourself by, what you did for others. Define yourself by contentment. You don't have to do something extraordinary that the rest of the world thinks extraordinary. Define for yourself what you want. Try and be immune from the outside pressure of defining who you are, but go on your own path. Go on one that you really believe in, that it sort of matches your moral compass and your moral character. And when you start working, do work that you enjoy doing. You're going to spend more time at that job than you are spending the money you made at that job. So make sure what you're spending your time with is something you love. When my kids all, man, I'm 67 now. They go, Dad, why don't you retire? Why are you doing that? I go, you know what? Because I love what I'm doing. And that's the reason I do it is I enjoy it. I found something that I enjoy doing. And sometimes when my kids were younger, I would describe it to them in their terms and say, work is like the biggest video game in the world. And like you, I sort of am sad at night when I have to put it away and I can't wait to wake up in the morning and start playing it again. And does it consume my life? Probably. I'm enjoying it. I love it. And I hope you find something that you love too. And focus on that, not whether people think it's a good job. Almost every job I've taken, people thought was a crappy job when it started out. When I went to AOL, which turned out to be, the Google and Facebook of its era in the 90s, we had half the traffic of the internet. But when I went there, it was sort of the internet was just coming on. Its future was in doubt. And I had I was at Century 21 Real Estate, and I had a couple of people saying, I don't know why you want to leave Century. I know why they want you, but I don't know why you'd leave Century 21 to go to AOL. It seems sort of silly today after what happened. But at those moments in time, they, you know, when I went to iHeart, it was Clear Channel, and it was a company way over levered and a lot of problems. And so we turned it into something really exciting. But I think you can't be you can't go by whether people approve of the job you're taking. The question is, does it get under your skin? Does it intrigue you? And I think that's what makes a great job, is just the curiosity is just sky high, that there's just something about it that won't leave you, that your mind keeps going back to. And those are good indications that it's something you probably want to spend your time with.
And the video game metaphor of life, you're right. It's never ending levels and kind of richer levels. And I, this is probably a good time to bring in, because Dad, I've never told you this story. Bob and I met at one of these weird video game levels where you accidentally enter in the wrong code and you go to Mars. And I met Bob maybe 11 years ago. I had recently moved out to LA. I started making these dinky YouTube videos, and one of these, you know, is the American Psycho Talking Heads video, and it blew up and it was really cool. And the guy who produced it with me, Jake Avnet, talented young producer, we didn't know what we were doing. He said, "Hey, this is nuts, but let's drive out to the Nevada desert. There's this thing, Burning Man. And, you know, my buddy's dad has a setup." And I said, "What? I mean, do we need to, is it like a survival thing?" He's like, "I don't know, but bring a t-shirt and I think we may have a place to stay." And so we hopped in the car and drove out, and the laws of gravity disappeared. I stumbled into Bob's camp, having no idea who he was and who some of his campmates were. And it was one of the most extraordinary experiences of my life, and actually ended up shaping the course of my life. But first off, because we'll never get another chance, Bob, how do you explain a place like Burning Man to a former central banker? A place where money doesn't even exist.
I think central bankers probably do well there. I think, to me, I went to Burning Man when I was 50 years old, and I had just come out of working full time since I was 15. I'd never taken off time to backpack Europe or see the world. I'd spent my time working. I was a little bitter. I made enough money that I didn't have to work. And I said, I'm going to now spend my 50s sort of understanding what's out there. And I think the hardest problem we have when we get old is that the blinders come on. Our world begins to narrow. Pretty soon we got that same tennis game every Saturday morning. We got the same golf game every Wednesday. We go to Mildred and Joe's house every Wednesday night for fish or whatever. Whatever it is, but we get into a pattern, a rut. And to me, what's great about Burning Man and still is it pushes the blinders back. And I go, what? And I remember the first time I walked in there and I looked out on the playa, which is the, at night, which is the big open area, 2 miles across, I think. And there's all these vehicles people have created with lights. And in those days, a lot of fire. And I'd never seen anything like it. And I'm just dumbfounded to the point that every time I go to Burning Man, I want to find somebody I've never been. And I want to walk out on the desert with them for the first time to see what's going on, to see it through their eyes again. And I think it's one of those experiences where it just opens your mind. And, you know, Burning Man is one of those places you can be anybody you want to be except an asshole. You've got to be respectful of other people, but sort of just experiment with whatever you got out there. And I think you just see some sheer creativity. You see some absolute garbage. You know, on the creative level, I would say it's sort of like the real world, that probably 80% of the stuff there is terrible. 10% is, 5% is, wow, that's really good. 4% is, that's amazing. And 1% is just like, where did that come from? And yeah. And there's a lesson too, because at Burning Man, the art and the creativity doesn't go through a selection process. You know, if you're a great artist, you got to find a gallery. Well, the gallery's got to believe you're good, and or they're not going to take you. So you're whittled down, but you never have a chance to present your stuff to the consumer. Now, YouTube has changed some of that, and some of the other places have, but it's this opportunity to put it out there. And I think coming out of that experience and to see everybody, and by the way, everybody's pretty equal out there. And, you know, I've had some friends say, "I want to go with you." And I go, I don't think you'll like it. There's no VIP room. There's no special line. You know, and by the way, in our camp, I don't care who you are, you're going to do kitchen duty. You're probably going to clean the latrines. You're going to go through the recycling. We all do work there. And we're all in it together, a real sense of community. But I think that's the reason. I sort of didn't know what I was getting into the first year. But that's the reason I go back again and again, is because it's a good, once a year, it's a good dose for me to sort of have faith in mankind, have faith in creativity, innovation, and just to see stuff that blows my mind. There was a study in the New York Times, Science Times, I forget, a few years ago, and it was talking about seeing stuff you've never seen before. They showed people, I think it was a picture or video, and said, "What do you see here?" And they saw X number of things. Then they exposed a group of those people to something they'd never seen before. I forgot what it was. In my mind, I thought, oh, this is Burning Man. And then they asked them to look at the picture again. People who had been unexposed to it and didn't see anything else. People who had seen something else suddenly saw all sorts of other things in that same picture. So it sort of wires you up to be more perceptive. And I think going to Burning Man is one of the tools I use to try and continue to be perceptive about life, about business, about people, etc.
If you start your day with a cup of coffee, then you're probably making it at home these days. The Bixby Coffee Club was designed to make your mornings a lot easier and a whole lot fresher. It's really simple. To join the club, all you do is select one of our delicious fresh roasted coffees and then choose how often you want it. That's it. If your home tends to go through a bag of coffee every couple weeks, now you'll have a fresh roasted restock sent just in time so you're never empty-handed. Go to BixbyCoffee.com and join the club. Use code GREATS for 30% off your first shipment. This is insanely fresh coffee. You know it the moment you've tried it. That's BixbyCoffee.com, B-I-X-B-Y coffee.com to join the club. Back to the conversation.
Good lesson. Miles.
And how to survive in dust. Lots of it.
Often without the benefit of clothing.
Yes, exactly.
Bob,
not for me, but for some people.
I'm curious, Bob, what currently your media diet is, how you consume things, because you've always been so many steps ahead of the public at large. I mean, it really, MTV was extraordinary, but what it really was, you know, a way to make television at a lower cost basis. You were ahead of the email newsletters with Thrillist and De La Candy. You got in on the tequila business before that was trendy for celebrities to do. And of course, always staying to the roots, radio being so intimate and in your head. How do you consume information now? And then how do you step away and kind of process it in a little bit of quiet on a daily basis?
You know, what I do is I try and look at it and say, what is it? And what cable networks were is exactly the same thing as on-demand stuff is today. What we knew was that the consumer did not want to be trapped to see news only at one time of the day, or to see music only on Friday nights, or children's programming on Saturday mornings. The consumer was looking for control. They were looking for convenience. I want to find what I want when I want it. So with MTV, we didn't think they were going to watch MTV 24 hours a day. And the folks at CNN didn't think they were going to watch news 24 hours a day. What we thought was, now the consumer can be their own programmer. They can get news anytime they want to by picking from a 24-hour news channel, get their music anytime they want to from a 24-hour music channel, get kids programming anytime they want to from a 24-hour kids programming. So before we had on demand, before it was technically feasible, that was the way we sort of gave people on demand. And if you remember, the first pay-per-view movies were, they just played over and over on a channel. So we had the Star Wars channel, the whatever channel. Each movie had its own channel. It just kept playing over and over again. So I could go to the movie. I had to hit the start time. I couldn't start it when I wanted to. I couldn't stop it. But it was always this movement toward total control, because ultimately the one belief I have that I've never seen violated is consumers want convenience. If I can take any product and give them more convenience for the product, I'll win. Not better quality. If it were better quality, I would never use a cell phone. I can barely hear people on it. I get dropped all the time. It's nowhere near the quality of my wired line, and what, 60% of the people in the U.S. don't have a wired line anymore or more. Again and again, the consumer picks convenience over quality. The microwave oven doesn't cook nearly as well as your oven, and sure didn't in the beginning, but boy, was it more convenient. And I think that the same is true with media, and what people are doing is we're on a quest to get exactly what I want when I want it. So anything that gives me a recommendation and helps predict what I like is good, helps me narrow down choices. Anytime I can take it and play it exactly when I want to, and by the way, the more devices I can play it on, the better, more convenient it is. And I think it continues to move in that direction. You know, when I got to what was then Clear Channel and became iHeart, we had AM, FM radio stations. And you entered contests by calling the phone number. Well, today you text to win. Today we're on 250 platforms in addition to AM, FM, that you can listen to us on your video game machine, your phone, Alexa speaker, the Alexa wireless speaker, or voice activated speaker is now the new clock radio. I wake up to it, but I give it a voice command. That the behavior that consumers want to do is the same. We in the media business get better and better in giving them that. You know, when the chat rooms began at AOL, I said, okay, there is no new behavior. What behavior is this? The behavior was going to a bar or going to a church social or going to a nightclub where I can go meet people, but it's a whole lot easier just to sit at home. And oh, by the way, if I'm going to meet somebody or I'm going to a club, I don't have to dress up. I can be in my underwear eating cereal and be on a chat room and get that experience. And by the way, Facebook has become that place in our lives as well. Instagram is we're sharing our Christmas cards every minute of our lives. Hey, look at me. Look at what's going on. Let me catch you up. And each one has a purpose. And by the way, it's getting harder for me because my two youngest kids are now in college. So I've lost my guinea pigs. But I used to do a lot just watching them to say, there's a new. But every time I see something new, I want to put it into some bucket I know of consumer behavior, because I don't think consumers have changed probably since the caveman days. They've just had technology that's allowed them to do things. And by the way, in a quest for easier and easier, more and more what I want, less and less what I don't want.
So, Bob, this trade-off between convenience and quality, how do you think it affects the ability to sort through what's real information or what's fake news, or how you govern a country where we are so far advanced technologically?
Yeah, I am. I just watched Social Dilemma.
Extraordinary. Incredible.
And I'm fearful because I grew up in another era that I do think can probably be terribly unpopular, but I do think at a certain point you just need some rules of what you can and cannot do. I'm not sure government regulation is the answer, but it is an answer. But what I do know is we need to do something, because I think we can't at a certain point, the consumer has to be protected a bit. I mean, we have the FDA, which makes you back up your claims. You know, it's at a certain point, we need something that helps us. We just launched a new network called the Black Information Network, which is the people in our company of the community have really built this network. It's enabled by iHeart. And we looked about a year ago and realized that the Black community had no all news service. They had talk services and entertainment, et cetera, but no all news service. So we set about building it, and we put it on the shelf during COVID because our ad revenue was down substantially. We had to make a lot of cuts, and we put it on the shelf. And after George Floyd's tragic death, the Tony Coles, who runs it, said, "Bob, you know what? I think we need to do this network now. I know we got to cut money. I don't know where the money's going to come from, but we need to do this." And we gulped hard, talked to the board. We did it. But we also realized that if we were going to launch this network and we made it advertiser supported that we would have to chase ratings. And the way you get a rating is not through balanced information, maybe a little dull. You get it by getting people's blood pressure up. You tell them sort of the story. You slant it a bit. You leave stuff out. Gets them like, what? How? Well, now I'm watching. I'm talking. I'm hanging on every word. And so we came up with this model that we have 10 slots for founding partners. And we found these major companies that shared our mission, said, you know what we want to do? We want the Black Information Network, yes, it's going to be for the Black community and make sure the Black community's perspective isn't everything, but we want to free the people running the network from this need to get a rating. We want them to build the most reliable, trusted news source they can. Want balance. We don't want name calling. We don't want to slant it. We want to put all the facts out there. Let them decide. And we found these major companies, God bless them, you know, McDonald's and Lowe's and Bank of America all came in with us. And it's so refreshing. I listen to it every morning to get my news because there is no name. Sometimes you just say, oh my gosh, just say it. But they don't say it. They resist the urge to say it. And they just give you the information. They give you this and then this. And you go, wow, it's like good old fashioned. And I think we need places where we can get that. And part of the problem is the economic models, as long as your advertiser supported, you have to play to the rating. So I think unless you sort of put some guardrails on it, like the FDA, and just say, okay, come on, enough's enough. This isn't a little slanting. This is a lot slanting. I was responsible for CNN as chief operating officer of Time Warner back when Fox began to really come on the scene. And we had a lot of debates internally about should we add opinion too? Should we take a position? In my day, we didn't. I think everybody sort of had to go that direction to a certain extent. They have to stand for something. But, there was a time, not too into the distant past, in which I had friends who had diametrically opposed points of view of me politically. And we were great friends, and we laughed at each other for having different points of view. We'd make fun of each other, but we were great friends about it. Today, that's gotten a lot more tense, and I think the world's gotten a lot poorer for it because I don't know about you, but to me, I find the most interesting people to talk to are people who have a completely different point of view than I have. I actually want to know why they think that. And I also know if I want to change their mind, I can't argue my conclusion against their conclusion. I have to go back and say, how did you arrive at that? What I can have influence on is their assumptions. And if I can, somebody will take me back and go through assumptions. By the way, half the time, they actually change my opinion when I go through the assumptions. But if I intend to change their opinion, I'm still better off understanding each of the assumptions, saying, well, you know, actually, that's the wrong factor. That's a little off. They go, well, really? Now, if you change an assumption, by nature, change the conclusion. But we've lost that in society where we've got people all pulling together and go, you know what? I'm not going to get it all my way. And you're not going to get it all your way. But we got to do something. Let's figure out something that we can do that it's a middle ground. That's good. And I just fear today that we've empowered intolerance instead of empowered tolerance. And maybe it's because I'm a preacher's son, but I just believe tolerance is the is really what's missing today. And going to your point, Miles, about social dilemma is, you know, sort of the point of it is, where's our tolerance? Where's our acceptance of other points of view? Yes. Why? Where did we suddenly come to a country where we're trying to squelch people's point of view as opposed to understanding other points of view?
And there's no context. Everything is just shrunk because of convenience, because humans are loyal to convenience. And so you get it immediately. But I'd like to hear you talk kind of big picture about podcasts, because I feel like podcasts provide that context and also provide time by, you know, creating a 25th, a 26th hour of the day where you can listen to it while you're doing something else. I have a group of about six of my closest friends growing up from Dallas and New England and internationally, all of different persuasions, all different lifestyles. And everybody contributes one podcast episode that they like to the group thread.
The book club.
And we all listen to it. It's the audio book club. Yeah. And when I hear, even on totally opposite political spectrums, when I hear an hour and a half of thoughtful people talking about it, it makes me so much more empathetic and curious. And I know you have a podcast. Here we are talking on a podcast, but you also are the CEO of the largest podcast platform in the universe. So can you tell us a little bit about that experience and then how, as a marketing genius, how do you market podcasts?
Sure. Look, I think you've hit on it. Is what's nice about this conversation is people haven't taken a sound bite of what I said and used that to represent my point of view. We've had time to go through and as you say, Miles, provide context, but it's also, we've had time to develop a story and a conversation. Podcasts allow that. And you're right about audio in particular, podcast in particular, is the American consumer has run out of time for their eyes. They have no more time. If they want to look at something else, they got to stop looking at something. They got to give up looking at something. But we have time for our ears. When I'm cooking, I'm walking, I'm lying in bed, I'm in the tub, I'm in the shower. I've got time for my ears. And so I think podcasting is very much a radio experience, but I contrast it to radio by saying, you know, I think if you go into a cocktail party and I see you, I might go, hey, Miles, how you doing? How's the family? How's the business? Hey, got any coffee? Aha. That's radio. Podcast is I go and say, Miles, I got somebody to talk to you about. Come over here for a minute. And we go in some really intense conversation about one time. That's a podcast. But it's sort of the same experience. We're just sort of focusing it differently. You know, another way to think about it is it's sort of podcasting is sort of what Netflix to radio, what Netflix is to TV. It's programming that could be on the radio. Some of it actually is on the radio. And it's this same sort of storytelling conversation, host driven. You know, what's interesting in podcasts, there are no podcasts that are a hit that aren't host driven. It is more about the host than anything else, just like radio is. And so when you think about that experience, can this be an enlightenment experience for people? Yes, because unlike what we were just talking about, you know, short clip news information, two lines, you know, a post, we've got enough time in a podcast to really delve into something with enough depth that we're not making it a caricature, but we're really exploring it. And then when you say, how do you promote it? You know, there are different ways you promote it as a marketer. I think the reason we're the number one podcaster is because we have radio. And how do we create a big podcast? We talk about them on the radio. We reach more people than any other company. We reach 91% of Americans every month. That's more than Facebook and Google in the U.S. It's way more than the TV, any TV network does. So we talk about the podcast on the air, and Zingo, we talked about one last week. It's number one on the Apple charts this week. It's number one on the iHeart podcast charts. You can't make something that's not a hit. But if you've got something that's a hit, if you promote the bejesus out of it, it will be a hit. And that's the way you create it. It's like, you know, we go through artists and we go through records, we go through songs, and our folks are trying to pick the next hit song. I'm sure there are plenty of hit songs we don't play and they don't become a hit because we didn't play them, but they become hits, big hits, because we do play them and expose them to this extraordinary audience on our music stations. Podcasting's no different. And so we're able to do it. I think there are other ways to do it. It all starts, though, with promotion. You either get an existing podcaster to talk about the new podcast. Right. You go do press, and you get the press talking about it. You buy adverts. Some people buy a lot of advertising. You see it on billboards today. And so there, you've got to get the word out. The more podcasts there are, the harder. But I think the beauty of podcasting is not every podcast has to have a huge audience. It just needs to find its audience. And some great podcasts are for actually very small audiences. But that small audience loves it. And it's important to them. They're super fans. And I think in podcasting, there's a room for that. On linear radio, there's not, because we only have 24 hours in a day. So I can't fit everything in. But on podcasting, we can fit it in. I think there are 1 million podcasts now. There's room for them all. Sadly, we sort of have to be in the business of, not sadly, I guess, fortunately, of the really big hit podcast. But you know, there's room for any podcast anywhere.
As we just wrap up, Bob, you know, as you are entering your seventh decade on Earth, what is a new skill that you're kind of committed personally to improving? And then what is your prayer for this country and your grandchildren going forward?
Well, I think in terms of skills, I'm just trying to hang on to the ones I've got. If I could just remember what I did yesterday and what I ate for breakfast, I would be such a happy man. Richard's laughing because he knows this well. So I'm hanging on. I want keep my reflexes as good as they can. My dad died at age 94. And he was still driving well into his late 80s, but he every day would say, are you going to take the keys away from me? So I'm like, I'm at that moment where I don't want my kids taking the keys away from me. So I'm going to try and hang on to everything I can to keep my keys. I think in terms of the country, you know, what I hope for in this country is that we figure out a way. And I think those of us in media and entertainment have a special responsibility to foster this. And by the way, in technology too, is I think we need to figure out how we create understanding, how we can foster understanding and bring people together, not bring people apart. And I think it starts with a desire to create understanding, not attack people, not yell at people. I've never seen any books that say the best way to persuade somebody is to yell at them or to call them a name, but to have an enormous amount of respect for people who even have a much different point of view and start off with the fact of let's give everybody the benefit of the doubt and assume everybody has good heart and everybody wants to do good and not assume that they are have some terrible motive or they're horrible human beings. They may be doing something terrible. I suspect they don't think they're doing something terrible. So I think it's understanding, and I'm trying in every way I can. And what we do as a company is to foster understanding, to open the doors to information and diverse points of view, and to create an opportunity for diverse voices to have a platform too, so they can be heard. I think one of the more interesting things we've done in the past year is the Breakfast Club, Charlemagne the God, DJ Envy, Angela Yee, had a conversation with Rush Limbaugh after the George Floyd killing, and it was simulcast on Rush's show. And it was also on our hip hop and our R&B stations. So I think that you expose to an audience a point of view they may have not heard before directly. And I think there are things like that which we can do all over this country, which we need to do. And I think the country will benefit from. And I think the people who do it are courageous, because right now, if you talk about points of view that are not concentric with your own or your audience, people attack you. So we've got to have some people who are brave enough to do it. But I think if we don't have those people, we fall into it. I often wondered how Joe McCarthy could have ever gotten away with what he did. But it scares me a little bit, because it seems like right now intolerance is sort of back to that early 50s point of view, regardless if you're on the left or the right. It's just the idea of we're seeking understanding instead of accusing is maybe the message of the day, which is a sad message. So I'm hopeful about understanding. And I think at a certain point, you know, when things get bad enough, or when we have some lessons of this yelling isn't going to get anything done, and we're not going to solve problems, at that point, maybe we begin to move the other direction, which move coming back together.
Amen.
Hear, hear. Well, thank you, Bob. This was really a treat. So grateful to
thanks,
you for your
guys.
Time.
This is great. It's great fun. thank you. And good luck with everything. And may we all come out of this COVID thing soon.
Hey, Bob, do you have a coffee machine at your house? Can I send you some coffee?
Thanks for listening to another great episode of Coffee with the Greats. If you haven't already, please do subscribe to this podcast so that the next episode will appear magically on your phone when it comes out. And check out Bixby Coffee to discover a better way to brew at home. Use code GREATS for 30% off your first order and free shipping at Bixby Coffee, BIXBY Coffee.com.